to walk us through introductions and hearing from our speakers, I'd like to first call upon Rabbi Weiner to share a little bit about the roots of hatred and the act of confronting hate as part of our tradition and our Jewish story, and how this informs today's topic. And if you could also please share with us what inspired you to be in your line of work at Cedars.
Okay, well, thank you, Mary, and thank you all. It's really wonderful to be with you. Although I am down the road at Cedars-Sinai, I did my clinical pastoral education training at Children's Hospital, and it's just such an incredible place. Yeah, it holds a really special place in my heart. So it's really, you know, quite an honor to be with all of you who I look up to and respect so much, and the incredible work that you all do. When talking about addressing the roots of anti-Semitism from a kind of a rabbinic perspective, from the tradition and what our rabbinic tradition has to offer, you know, there's been a lot, of course, discussed on where does it come from? Where does hatred of the Jews, it's such an ancient and intense hatred, where does it come from? And some people have suggested maybe it's economic factors, or some have suggested scapegoating or ethnic factors, xenophobia, resentment of professional success or religious bigotry. There's all sorts of reasons people have suggested, but none of those are really the causes of anti-Semitism. There may be issues that exacerbate it, but the truth is that anti-Semitism has existed wherever Jews have lived from the beginning of Judaism. And so the question is why? And our rabbis actually give a fascinating and profound answer, and it's an answer that I go back to over and over again when I try to analyze and think through different issues that are arising and how we might respond to it. And the truth is, the answer, it's actually based in, and I don't know if this timing was intentional, but the holiday that we just celebrated last week of Shavuot. The rabbis say, the Talmudic sages say that the truth is, the roots of anti-Semitism are in Judaism itself. What does that mean? The rabbis say that, Ba Sinai yarda sinah le'olam. At Sinai, it's a play on words. At Mount Sinai, when the Ten Commandments were given, Sina, hatred, came to the world. Meaning this, there's some idea that the rabbis conceptualized it as a Jewish challenge to the world, or a challenge of the status quo, that actually created a backlash of anti-Semitism, that there's this allegiance to God, to Torah, to peoplehood, that made Jews into an outsider and challenged the validity of the gods or the allegiances at that time and made the Jews separate. And this focus on influencing or impacting the world, l'takeno lamba malchut shaddai, like changing the world and challenging other systems to make like sort of moral demands on these systems, creates a certain tension. And that's why actually the rabbis called whenever a Jew is murdered for being Jewish, such as has happened in recent years, unfortunately, in synagogues, for example, when a Jew is just killed randomly being in a synagogue, the rabbis refer to that as dying al kiddush Hashem. Because they saw that as representing a threat to the core values, their beliefs and allegiance that to standing up for what's right, that is sort of representing God in the world. And the rabbis conceptualized this as that the existence of Jews has been seen as threatening since the beginning of time, that there's these different values and allegiances that constitute a threat to the prevailing order, which is why actually totalitarian regimes always become anti-Semitic. They want to control their citizens, and this theme of Judaism undermines their desire to control their people. And so the rabbis saw anti-Semitism as always sort of being inevitable. And so just to conclude, I mean, if that's so, I mean, it's kind of depressing when sometimes I think about that. It's like, so what does that mean then? Therefore, there will always be anti-Semitism in the world? Like, so the response, the way that I at least understand it, is that if the cause of anti-Semitism is Judaism, and anti-Semitism is a response to the Jewish way of life or Jewish values, then it will never be eliminated. But to reduce it, there could be an insight there. So what would be the response? Could it be assimilation? Many have tried that. That hasn't necessarily worked to prevent anti-Semitism. Could it be Zionism? That doesn't necessarily solve the problem for all Jewish people. And there's also national hatred. Should the solution be seeking converts, which actually could potentially backfire? The solution could be to fight it politically, physically, you know, persecute criminals or cancel offenders. But that sort of deals with the symptoms, not necessarily the cause. And sometimes it makes things worse. And so I believe that perhaps if we take seriously this idea that B'Sinai Yarda Sinah, that at Sinai is when anti-Semitism came into the world, then the solution might be, ironically, that the Jewish task, which is the cause of anti-Semitism, has to be fulfilled in order to end anti-Semitism. Meaning teaching the world the values of goodness, kindness, universalism that seeks to help people, that could be the only way that teaching those values can have an influence. So in other words, we have to make the world aware of the sort of God-based ethical system, these Jewish values, to try to influence the world in some way to live in accordance with these universal moral values. Obviously, we're not seeking converts. We're trying to teach moral universal values, and that these religious moral values can both cause anti-Semitism and be the solution to it. It's the irony of Jewish history, that spreading basic Jewish ethics is the cause and the solution. And maybe in the question and answer session, I'll share with you a little bit how I think that also actually hospitals in particular have a unique role to play in that issue. And maybe I'll share that with you further in the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Weiner, for those profound remarks. I think for so many of us, this is a really important lesson to have learned, and we definitely will circle back to you as we get through the call and explore more about this topic and this the point that you've shared. Thank you. I want to do that first.
Okay, sure. maybe to answer your question, I will give you the...
We can't hear you. You're muted. Sorry.
My bad. So I think in order to answer your question, I will give the example of the hospitals that I was referring to, because I think it does summarize it, which is that, you know, we know that in the history of American hospitals, about 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago, there was widespread missionizing of sick Jews in hospitals. There was forced scripture reading, deathbed baptisms, because the most sick were seen as the most vulnerable. And there was actually a diagnosis in the AMA, the American Medical Academy's textbook, in the 1930s that all doctors used when they studied medicine. The diagnosis was called Hebraic debility. In some textbooks, they called it Jew neurasthenia. And they described it as the condition of being subhuman, dirty, nervous, and difficult. And they thought it was potentially contagious. So they obviously treated Jews very poorly as a result. And in fact, also, Jewish medical students were harassed, were not given hospital jobs or privileges. In fact, we know of a case in Montreal where a Jew was hired in a hospital and the doctors went on strike in order to avoid working with a Jew. And then the Jew was fired. Medical schools limited enrollment of Jews. And so what happened as a result was just a fascinating example of this issue and this question was that there was a creation of Jewish hospitals throughout America. And when these Jewish hospitals were created, there was an initial debate, which was, should non-Jews be allowed in the Jewish hospitals? Now, that was debated initially, but there was unanimous decision in all these hospitals immediately that anyone should be allowed, regardless of religion or ability to pay and race, background, everything. They wanted everyone to be welcome. They felt like it would be hypocritical if we were excluded if we exclude others. And what's fascinating is that we see in some of the board meetings of these hospitals was that they were very proud that they included equal numbers of non-Jews and Jews. And they wrote there that they hoped that this would be the solution to reduce anti-Semitism by being inclusive and welcoming. And we actually know that we have like the quotes from many of the ceremonies that the rabbi said at the openings of these hospitals. For example, right across the street from Children's Hospital, at the opening ceremony for Cedars of Lebanon, the rabbi said, you know, cedar trees symbolize the ancient temple in Jerusalem. And the rabbi there said, just like the ancient temple in Jerusalem was a house of prayer for all people of all backgrounds, so too will this be a house of healing for all people of all backgrounds. And in fact, by the way, that hospital, which was Casper Cohen before, was the first hospital in California to hire a woman to hold a supervising position as a physician in California. The idea was, if we're being excluded by other hospitals, we want to include everyone. We want to, even the AMA doesn't want to accept women. Well, we'll accept women. 1947, the Jewish Hospital of Cincinnati hired two African-American physicians in opposition to Jim Crow laws. And in 1951, the Louisville Jewish Hospital, and that's what they were called, by the way. They're often called Jewish Hospital. They hired a Dr. Jesse Bell, which was the first African-American doctor hired in a non-African-American hospital in that region. And so you saw that hospitals had this, Jewish hospitals had this idea that the way we fight anti-Semitism is not by doing what they did to us, but is actually by being as open, inclusive, welcoming, and kind as possible. And unfortunately, and this is just the point that I want to make, the attitude to fighting anti-Semitism in America has shifted from combating it via kindness, philanthropy, welcoming, inclusivity, sharing values and morals, to fighting it head on and trying to, you know, cancel people and make them look bad and show how evil they are and trying to convince sponsors not to sponsor them anymore. And it becomes this battle. And you ask about mental health. I mean, the process of fighting through, you know, it's a never ending cycle when we're constantly trying to cancel people. The process of fighting anti-Semitism can actually be more damaging to the one who's fighting than the one who's the one causing the anti-Semitism. Whereas my contention is that the role model of Jewish hospitals 100 years ago in the first approach they took, which is trying to be kind and inclusive and share Jewish values and welcome everyone and simply look the other way to hate, but instead, when, you know, sort of speak the line when they say, you know, when they go low, we go high, like that kind of attitude of sort of like, we're just going to be the big ones and be kind and be good and, you know, and try to combat anti-Semitism that way. To me, that's both meant in terms of mental health, the safest attitude, and also, I think, likely in the long run, the most effective approach.
Thank you so much for that perspective. I add, you know, as a resilient people, our responsibility to one another and ourselves is to continue to be inclusive and to continue to be open. Thank you for sharing that.
Exactly.
I'd love to hear, we'll close with where we started with Rabbi Weiner and then transition to Dr. Alan Nager.
Sure, thank you. I think just for one final statement, I'd like to answer a question that's in the chat because I think it's so important. It's what I wanted to address anyways, which was that the question was, how do you confront the statement that the Jewish community is just overreacting to anti-Semitism and that the hate isn't worse than any other racial or ethnic community? And I think that's exactly the point. The point is not to compete for who has it worse or where the worst types of hatred is, but rather to express solidarity and to be curious to learn from others and to be able to create a universalistic message where we say, here's the things that we've experienced. We want to learn from you what you've experienced. We want to be able to work together and express solidarity and support for you and work together, hopefully all of us, to make a safer and better community for the world to come, for all people.
Thank you. And.